You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. A week or two ago, I heard a lawyer I know say that he wanted his group to become the Mayo Clinic of law firms. It wasn't the first time I'd heard someone refer to themselves as the Mayo Clinic of this or that, and it dawned on me that I really didn't know what the Mayo Clinic is. In fact, I might have even thought it was a mental institution. Sure, I'd heard the name many times over the years, and I suppose I probably had some idea that it was a good hospital, but the truth is I had no concept of why the Mayo Clinic is so famous, and why for so many people it is their reference point not just for medicine, but for all-around excellence. Then I watched a wonderful documentary by my friend Ken Burns titled The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science. And I finally understood why for over 150 years, patients and doctors alike have flocked to this medical center in the middle of a Minnesota cornfield. The film The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science airs this Tuesday at 9 Eastern on PBS. And today, Ken Burns returns to the podcast to share the incredible story of a country physician and a Franciscan nun who built the medical institution known as the Miracle in Minnesota. He talks about the natural disaster that led to the formation of the Mayo Clinic, the astonishing success rate of founder Dr. W.W. Mayo at a time when going to the hospital was considered a death sentence, and how he and his staff innovated everything from sterilization and surgery right down to how patients are treated and even how those patients' medical records are kept. Then he reveals how the Mayo Clinic continues to take the profit motive out of medicine and put the focus back on the patient, how an institution with more than 62,000 employees still manages to provide personal care rather than treat people like a number, and why the doctors of the Mayo Clinic believe that faith and hope are every bit as essential to healing as science. Plus, he shares just a few of the touching testimonials from people whose lives were changed by the Mayo Clinic, including the late Senator John McCain in one of his final interviews. Coming up with filmmaker Ken Burns in just a moment. Today, I'm happy to welcome back to the podcast acclaimed filmmaker Ken Burns. He's a two-time Oscar nominee and the winner of multiple Emmys and Peabody Awards. His epic historical documentaries have included The Civil War, Baseball, Jazz, The War, The National Parks, Prohibition, The Roosevelts, and last year's Emmy-nominated 10-part series, The Vietnam War. Now he's directed and produced The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science, which airs Tuesday, September 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern on PBS. Ken Burns, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
You know, I've heard of the name Mayo Clinic, and I suppose I probably had some vague concept of it as simply a good hospital. But unless you've been a patient there, you really have no idea what a vast and remarkably innovative organization the clinic is. When did you first become aware of what an institution the Mayo Clinic is?
I bumped into the CEO and president in the summer of 2010, and I went there to get a checkup in early 2011 and was blown away. I'd heard about the Mayo. I knew that it had a great reputation. I knew that it was a kind of Mecca or Lourdes for a lot of people. But I hadn't really put it all together of how it could possibly be so different from any other healthcare experience I'd had or loved ones had had through the course of my life. And suddenly, here was it. I mean, I took a blood sample at 7 o'clock or 7:30 in the morning. By 9 o'clock when I had my first appointment, they had all the results. It wasn't a week later. It wasn't 10 days later. It wasn't 2 weeks later. Every doctor in the place could access it. My doctor didn't spend 10 minutes with me because he needed to see 8 patients that hour in order to make his nut. He spent an hour and a half with me, and you were sort of like going, well, don't you have other people that you have to see? And during the course of the conversation, a very thorough annual checkup, he also put me in touch with many other specialists who he would call up and say, could you see him? Now, this wasn't 6 weeks later or 9 weeks later. It was later that afternoon.
So many people throughout its history have a similar experience to you when you went there. And also you interviewed Tom Brokaw, who's been a patient at the Mayo Clinic. And he said something interesting. He said, once you've been to the Mayo Clinic, you pretty much become an evangelist for them. It sort of speaks to these Midwestern values behind the clinic where, you know, if you just do your job well, you don't have to spend a lot of money on marketing. Your clients will be the best advertising you could ever hope for.
That's exactly right. And Tom, you know, it's actually a challenge for us as filmmakers, historians, journalists, you know, because you do have this experience and you want to share the herald of good news. But you need to, as we do in public broadcasting, have a complete separation between subject and us, between underwriters and us. And we have to make the film we have to make. And so, you know, I tried at one point to talk the Mayo out of letting us do this film. I just said, you know, give him 10 reasons not to do it and said the last one was, what if we find out something terrible? And there's a silence. And to his ever-loving credit, the president and CEO, John Noseworthy, said, well, if you found something, we'd want to know what it was and make it better. At that point, it's sort of like you got me at hello. Okay, I'm back. And that's, you're absolutely right. It's called the Midwestern Nice, but it seems to have translated to Arizona, to Scottsdale, Arizona, mm-hmm. and to Jacksonville, Florida. Like when you go through the doors of Mayo Clinic, you're in the land of Mayo Clinic. You're not anywhere else you've ever been before.
And all of this came out of a natural disaster over 150 years ago. Tell us a little about the origins of the Mayo Clinic.
They have a creation, not a mythology, but a creation fact. It's an amazing story. And if you think what happens, 1883, there's a huge tornado that destroys a good deal of the northern part of Rochester. And this incredibly sort of forward-thinking, humane family, W.W. Mayo and his sons, Will and Charlie. And they've got a small practice. And W.W. and his sons, who have yet to go to medical school but have been helping him for years, are out there attending to people in dance halls and homes and businesses. And he suddenly has this idea that the Sisters of St. Francis have this seminary, and it's summertime, so the students are gone. He sends for Mother Alfred Mose and says to Mother Alfred, can we use your room? She goes, of course. And she comes back to him and said, I just had a vision from God that I am to build you a hospital that will become renowned for its medical care around the world. And he says, yeah, right. And they build it. And he operates for years. And the sons grow up and go to medical school. And they operate for years and even improve on this early model and continue it going and bring in multi-specialists into this family practice. And it's, at that time, doctors sort of held all their information close to the vest. You didn't share it for fear of that, all the things we see out in the world today that come. I have a proprietary interest in this thing. And they just said, no, we're willing to learn and share. And it's been a remarkable story. You could not make this up and sell it to a Hollywood producer. It would just be, you know, too fanciful, too far-fetched. And, you know, that's why I've stayed in documentary because, you know, as Shelby Foote said to me when we were finishing the Civil War, he says, you can't make this up. God is the greatest dramatist. Abraham Lincoln wins the war on Good Friday, April 9th, when Lee surrenders to Grant at Appomattox. And then a few days later, he feels like he has enough free time now to go to the theater.
A lot of it does play out like a movie because I remember watching the documentary and it reminded me of Field of Dreams. You know, it's an unusual place to found a major medical center. We're not talking about New York or Chicago. They literally built the Mayo Clinic in a cornfield in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly. And it's still, you know, it's a city right now, but it's not that big a city. And it's still in the middle of cornfields. And it's, you know, there's an interesting statistic that they were performing more operations per year. I think it was in 1905 when Rochester then had a population of 7,000 than Johns Hopkins did in Baltimore, which had a population of 500,000.
Wow.
And the reputation just spread like wildfire because ordinary people could just walk in there and come by train from Alberta, Canada, and have this thing fixed and sent back home.
Yes, and it seems so perfectly Midwestern that all of this originated with a handshake between the doctor, W.W. Mayo, and a nun. And that deal has held for over 150 years. Even today, there's still no written contract between the nuns and the clinic.
That's correct. It's an amazing story of the nuns. You think, well, that's cute and anachronistic in 19th century. The nuns are still there. They have a values council to make sure that those nuns and their Franciscan values are part of the equation as they negotiate the day-to-day, you know, figuring out how you keep at this in the right way.
And both the Mayo family and the nuns have left their mark on the clinic. What did they each bring to the table?
They've got this great story, and there's these two parallel sort of worlds that coexist perfectly within Mayo. One is one that's about service, keeping true to these values that the patient is first, some of the Franciscan values, the values that the Mayo's brought to the table, and how you do that over time. The other is that they've got a well-oiled system to make sure that happens. They actually hire and continue to hire engineers that help them make sure that these efficiencies will not only stay true to the values, but also be literally that, efficiencies. And so they're able to do these things so much quicker, so much better.
And I want to ask you about that, because aside from these very advanced surgeries they were performing, they innovated and streamlined the entire hospital experience. For instance, they started putting the labs next to the operating room. What did that do?
Pathology next to the operating table. In 1905, one of the Mayo brothers challenged a pathologist to figure out a way to get a biopsy quicker than usual. He did, and they put the pathology department right next to the operating table. Why is this important? Well, say you're a woman and you're undergoing a breast operation for breast cancer, and they pull out the mass and they send it to pathology, and they know before they sew her back up whether the margins are clear, meaning they've gotten it all. More often than not, because the pathology takes a long time in other places, you've sewn the patient back up, they've gone home, and a week later the doctor said, the margins aren't clear, come in for a second, maybe a third operation. But Mayo's got this system, a well-oiled system that still puts you, the patient, first, that's able to cut down fourfold on those secondary and tertiary operations. I mean, that in and of itself ought to be worth the price of admission.
Certainly. And it's hard to overemphasize the importance of these seemingly simple ideas like having a team of doctors treat a patient or all those doctors having access to the same information. something as simple as centralized patient records, which we take for granted today, was groundbreaking.
You know, Siddhartha Mukherjee, the Pulitzer Prize-winning oncologist who wrote the great book, The Emperor of All Maladies, The History of Cancer, said that, you know, they had this understanding that your heart doesn't exist in the cardiologist's office. Your lungs don't exist in the pulmonologist. Your spine doesn't, you know, isn't there. They understood that they resided with the patients. And so the records followed them. Mm-hmm. And they were centralized in a way that permitted the maximum amount of collaboration to come in and say what would be good. And there's one incredibly complicated case that we tell early on in the film, a contemporary case, in which we have this wonderful, lovely eye doctor who's trying to cure a woman of eye cancer. She is pregnant at the time, and there is a sense that pregnancy is not only making her baby grow, but making the cancer grow. And the question becomes, what do you do about the baby? And he's an eye doctor and is sort of suggesting that she might have, as they put it, elective termination. She sees a gynecologist and OBGYN who says, okay, let's talk about this. And what they're able to do through collaboration is figure out how to save her and the baby, and they do. And I hope I'm not giving it away, but it's just a phenomenal, phenomenal moment in which you realize some of our sort of politically correct ideas, we forget to select for those people who have the desire to keep that baby or the desire to do things both. And Mayo figures out how to do it both, have it both ways. It's great. You know, pancreatic cancer patient who comes there, 4% survival rate. Every other doctor has said, get your affairs in order. He's still alive. He's still alive. 5 years in remission. Thinks he has, you know, 25 more years in him. And it's because the surgeon inverted the protocol, the traditional protocol for the treatment of this particularly pernicious brand of cancer.
Amazing. And when the Mayo Clinic opened and began trying these new techniques, medicine was only just beginning to emerge from the dark ages. These were still the days when people wanted to avoid hospitals at all costs because you were just as likely to leave a hospital worse off than when you came in, if you left at all. By contrast, what was the success rate at the Mayo Clinic in those first years?
It was really impressive. It's really post-Civil War, but you're right. When W.W. Mayo emigrated from England, he came and worked as a chemist at Bellevue Hospital, and hospitals were then places where people came to die, and the accreditation of doctors was, you know, hit and miss at best, lots of quacks, and he decided he didn't want to do that, ended up in the frontier, finally ended up in Rochester, Minnesota, judging who was fit to serve in the Union Army, and his wife, tired of their peripatetic lifestyle, just said, we're here. And they sort of set down roots. And, you know, by the 1880s with this tornado, they've got a practice that's one of the few in the county, but they're helping people and they're known. And then by 89, when the nurses are able to build this hospital for them, all of a sudden this exponential explosion of success takes place where I think, you know, in the first few years there at St. Mary's Hospital, which is what the Franciscan sisters called the building they built, which is still there to this day, added on a gazillion times, they you know, operated on 400 people, like two people died. And so the word began to spread all around the country and then around the world.
Right. And it wasn't just a destination for patients, but for other doctors as well. Surgeons came from all over to this little town in Minnesota just to observe the Mayo brothers in action. What kind of things were they coming there to see?
Well, I think they were seeing at first kind of mechanical excellence. I mean, surgeons are in some ways mechanics. They're working not on a car body, but a human body. And there's a certain amount of art and a certain amount of skill and a certain amount of curiosity and logic, and in their case, a willingness to learn. So the great thing is that the Mayo Clinics not only let us into their operating rooms, they let us into their archives. And you have all these series of photographs of these operating theaters that had to get bigger and bigger and bigger as these crowds of other physicians and students would just come there to learn and sometimes to be treated themselves. And a Chicago doctor saying, hey, these guys are way advanced of anything that we're doing here. And they're out. And this is at a time when it's a tiny, tiny podunk town. on the edge of the frontier, we say, as it once was in the early part of the 19th century. And they suddenly have these amazing results. He's already this great doctor who has this kind of great social conscience that we sort of admire and somehow don't always exalt in American history. We want to talk about the Carnegies and the great fortunes that are made and then the philanthropy that follows. They're doing it simultaneously. So that level of patient care, that level of unforced curiosity about who you are, that sort of high level of just listening. It permits a woman from Corn, Oklahoma, who's had years and years and 40 doctors and been near death and been almost complete collapse of various systems, comes to Mayo, talks to a doctor for 2 hours or an hour and a half, goes out in the waiting room with those little buzzers, and 20 minutes later, he buzzes her and said, "I've got your diagnosis." And it's, you know, a disease they know how to treat, and now she has her life back. Whereas nobody had connected all the dots because she kept seeing specialists, none of whom, like the blind men describing the elephants, knew that trunk, knew those ears, knew those legs, knew that skin, knew that tail. But nobody had the whole picture. And what Mayo learned in the 19th century is that you have to have the whole picture. And then that permits all these specialists to be having conversations with each other that can only benefit you.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Ken Burns when we come back in just a moment. Hey, folks, here's some advice for anyone who sends emails to their customers. You deserve a better email marketing platform, one that's actually designed with your type of organization in mind. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first, offering powerful email marketing with a personal touch. With Emma, you'll have everything you need to connect your data, build your audience, and do your most successful marketing ever. Because their easy-to-use platform makes advanced functionality accessible to everyone on your team, no technical skills required. You can even connect Emma with the services you count on to run your business, like Salesforce and Google Analytics. Not to mention, Emma's award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more. So put the power of email experts behind your marketing. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. Life can be stressful, and sometimes we lose perspective on what really matters. As we rush to achieve all the things we want in life, it can be easy to forget to enjoy the smaller moments along the way. But life isn't about following a common path or having a set plan. It's about being with friends, celebrating with loved ones, and living in the moment. Heineken believes that you create the richest memories when you embrace the unexpected and open yourself to new experiences. That's why Heineken encourages everyone to live spontaneously. Because when you embrace the unexpected, things like exploring new parties, enjoying the summertime, watching exciting soccer matches, and celebrating the holidays with your family, all become chances to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it up. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers! Folks, I'm so happy to have Bombas as a new sponsor of the podcast because I'm a huge sock guy. I know that sounds weird, but it's true. Everyone who's been on the show knows I always have some funky socks on my feet. Not funky as in smelly, but funky as in fun colors, whimsical, fashion-forward, but also functional and comfortable. And as a sock connoisseur, let me say that nobody makes a better sock than Bombas. Thanks to 2 years of research and development and multiple improvements in design, performance, and comfort, Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. With an arch support system that provides extra support where you need it most and a cushioned footbed that's reinforced for comfort without added bulkiness, Bombas feel like a hug around your foot. Not to mention, Bombas Stay Up technology ensures that your socks stay in place without leaving a mark. And the super soft cotton material makes you never want to take them off. So whether you're a runner, power walker, or power lounger, that's me, there's a pair of Bombas that'll add comfort to your life. As a matter of fact, I'm wearing a pair of purple Bombas Marl's calf-length socks even as we speak. They come in every color of the rainbow, and I ordered them all because they look great and they're easily the most comfortable socks I've ever owned. There's a good reason. These socks are scientifically engineered for comfort. Think about that. How much time do you spend trying to find a comfortable pair of shoes? Now ask yourself how much thought you've ever given to your socks. Socks go on your feet too, folks, and if you're suffering from tired feet, consider this. Maybe you've got the right shoes, but the wrong socks. You owe it to your feet to find out what a perfectly engineered sock feels like. Take it from me, they're a game changer. Go to bombas.com/kick and use the code KICK for 20% off your first order. That's Bombas, bombas.com/kick, code KICK, and you'll get 20% off your first order. A room filled with heroes, Dan Hansis, Greg Rosenthal, Chris Wessling, and Mark Sessler of the Around the NFL podcast deliver the latest news in the NFL. As NFL writers and reporters, the ATN crew has exclusive access to industry insiders and team personnel, allowing their listeners to feel in on all the action. The ATN podcast has you covered 52 weeks a year, recapping every game and every big story. If it happens in the NFL, you'll hear it on ATN. As the NFL preseason unfolds, stay up to date with the latest storylines affecting your favorite players and teams by following along on the ATN podcast 3 times a week. Whether it's a buzzworthy position battle, a new addition to the injury report, or perhaps a rookie stealing the show, Around the NFL highlights everything you need to know ahead of kickoff 2018. Subscribe now to the Around the NFL podcast and keep up with all 32 teams all year long. Available on your favorite podcast app or NFL.com. And now, back to the podcast. Well, this documentary is somewhat unusual for you because so often you're telling a history that is already written, but this is very much a living history that's still being written today. Did you approach this story differently than you might usually approach a more conclusive topic like, say, the Vietnam War or Prohibition?
Not really. This certainly, as you suggest, has these different structural elements. It is at its most basic form, an arc, a historical narrative from the beginning to the present. And that's been common in many other films that we've made. And something that I was experimenting with in the Vietnam War series was this idea of using particular moments in one time to sort of jump forward to a future time. So this essentially and then narrative that is the Mayo Clinic's narrative arc is punctuated several times by contemporary case studies that in some ways reflect that historical moment, or that historical moment gives you an opportunity to jump ahead. For example, early on in the narrative, W.W. Mayo, the patriarch of the family, has gone back from Minnesota to Bellevue Hospital, where he'd had some early training, and is envious of a $600 German microscope, which he wants to get, but it will require mortgaging the house. His wife is not ready to accept any debt, but she says if it's good for the people, then we'll do it. And at that point, we jump ahead to a discussion of the proton beam therapy, which is hundreds of millions of dollars in the contemporary moment, trying to save a little girl's, meaning a toddler's, life from brain cancer.
Yeah, and that was really interesting to me because I guess proton therapy is incredibly expensive, but they do something really remarkable at the Mayo Clinic. They actually take a loss, right?
It's very interesting. I wouldn't put it that way. I think almost everything about the Mayo Clinic is counterindicated. That is to say, just as your doctor's saying, don't mix this with this, everything they do seems to run counter to how we expect a hospital to be. They're nonprofit, whereas most things are trending towards profit-making institutions, and that has its own problems. They put the doctors on salary that fosters a kind of culture of collaboration, but also means no unnecessary tests and procedures. They have the pathology next to the operating room. I could go on and on. They put the patient first, which seems obvious, but if you think about it, it's always been the doctor that's first, and probably nowadays it's the hospital administrator and maybe even the insurance company looking over the administrator's shoulders. They put the patient first, and that's a hugely wonderful thing. So this film, in funny ways, many funny ways, reflects a film I made 35 years ago in the history of the celibate religious sect, the Shakers. The Shakers discovered that their poorer neighbors were stealing their crops at night. So the Shakers planted more crops, We plant some for the shakers, some for the thieves, some for the crows, they wrote. Thieves and crows have to eat too. And they also invented a wide range of things. Apparently the flat broom, apparently the circular saw. They invented a milk evaporator. And they held these without patent, were willing to share with their neighbors. And Clarence Borden apparently borrowed the milk evaporator and began his extraordinary company. What I'm trying to say is the Mayo has always been willing to say, we don't have any cards we're keeping close to our vests. This is what we know. What do you know? How can we be better? How can you be better? And one of the things they did in the middle of this debate recently, a few years ago, about their use, their supposedly destabilizing use of this hundreds of million dollar proton beam therapy machines, was that they decided to charge the same for that as they did for an X-ray. So all of a sudden, they took the argument out of it and said that there was a greater good. And it's a wonderful, very Mayo-like moment that the film pays attention to, but there are dozens more like that that remind you that it's not necessarily the way that we're used to having things run isn't necessarily the best way.
Yeah, and you're right. The Mayo Clinic stands in remarkably sharp contrast to the overall healthcare system in the U.S. You show a number of cases where modern-day patients were misdiagnosed or told that there was no solution, no answer, no cure by the doctors at home, and then they just seem flabbergasted when they arrive and they see the level of care that they get at the Mayo Clinic.
It occurred to me once the film was done, and I want to emphasize that, Ben, once it was done, I looked up and I said, our healthcare debate has been hijacked by politicians who don't know that much for the last at least 30 years, if not the last 105, 6 years. And what if sitting before us is the example of how you might do it well? Could we not sort of take back the conversation about it and begin to ask questions, not the political ones that say, my plan is right, yours is wrong, or I'm not on the same party as you, so I'm not voting for your plan, even though that plan that you've presented is the plan that my party originally developed in response to your party's failed attempt 30 years ago. And you kind of, our heads are shaking when we could have even better healthcare than possible. And I thought Mayo represented a really interesting example. That was not my job making the film. Our job, and it's co-directed by Eric and Chris Ewers. Eric has been an editor with me for almost 30 years, and Chris is a freelance cinematographer of the highest order that we've used and worked with for years and years and years. The three of us made the film together with the idea of just trying to wrestle to the ground the complicated narrative that you've just described that is not just a historical portrait, but also the combination of many, many case studies.
Are there best practices that can be upscaled to improve the overall healthcare system in the U.S.?
I believe so. I mean, I hope I'm not being naive, but they've figured out it's not even a secret sauce. I was going to say that because they don't keep anything secret. They want to share everything with everybody. And I think there are attempts throughout the country. They have satellite campuses that are their own in Jacksonville, Florida, and Scottsdale, Arizona. But they have a network of like-minded institutions, some of whom fall out because they just can't maintain the culture of Mayo for whatever reason. Maybe it has to do with the profit motive. Maybe it has to do with the sort of the quality of care and the ability to actually put the patient first, which seems to me as a layperson kind of duh and obvious. But in any case, they've done it right. And it's right in front of us. And they're not perfect. And we make sure that you see that. But we could, all of us, regardless of party, whatever you think, single payer or this or competitive marketplace, whatever it is isn't working, and they have things that work in the midst of this environment, and they do well, and they plow all their profits back into education and into training and into patient care and into research. And so you've got a kind of ideal situation. And unfortunately, I think we spend way too much of our time talking about successful leaders within a marketplace. And the Mayos, like many other great American things, have sort of taken themselves out of that. I mean, public broadcasting is one example. You and I work in radio and television in a medium that's got one foot tentatively in the marketplace and the other proudly out and is able to do a lot of things with that foot that's proudly out that can't be done in a commercial situation because the demands of that commercial situation don't select for that kind of excellence. And I'm saying that the Mayo Clinic represents that within the very important, much more important than public broadcasting, arena of our health. None of us are getting out of this alive, so we ought to have, while we're here, the best optimum possibilities for ourselves.
Just to give folks an idea of just the scale of this medical center today, this tiny town that probably, what, had 2,000 or 3,000 people in it when they first founded it? What has it turned into over the years? Give me an idea of how many surgeries they perform, how many people they employ.
So just imagine a small family practice, the father who's about to retire, the two sons who are coming into their own as surgeons, specializing in different parts of the body, a couple of associates. It's a group practice, and they're really good at it because they want to not only find out how to make their surgeries better, they also want to find those moments when you realize you don't need surgeries. And they're affiliated with a little hospital down the road a mile run by some Franciscan sisters. And today they have 64,000 plus employees in three campuses around the United States, in Scottsdale and Jacksonville, as well as Rochester, Minnesota, and are at the cutting edge. I think it was the U.S. News and World Reports just a few weeks ago rated the hospitals in the country, and Mayo came out number one, which I presume also means they're probably number one overall in the world. And that's the way the world thinks about it. We interviewed the Dalai Lama, who comes as a patient. We also interviewed John McCain. Now, those people, we don't go into depth as we do in the so-called ordinary people that populate most of the film in their case studies. But the three of them offer a kind of ratification of their radical, and I still want to use this word, counter-indicated way of doing things. It just doesn't make sense if you buy the generally accepted rules. But if you don't, then you're a quintessential American success story, or just a quintessential American story, which is the only things that I work on.
Were the John McCain interviews, had he been there because of his cancer treatment or did it go back to his injuries from Vietnam?
It's there because of his cancer treatment. I recorded him. I've known him for a couple of decades and we worked with him on the Vietnam film. Didn't interview him because he was then in active public life and didn't want that thumb on the scale. Mm-hmm. But he had gotten his diagnosis a few months earlier and he was at the Scottsdale campus in Arizona getting treatment and came back to Washington and I interviewed him for this and another project on Ernest Hemingway that's underway. And that twinkle in his eye as he looks forward to what is his inevitable death is one of the most courageous things. And I hope that just as I think we feel in a political sphere over the last few weeks that John McCain's service in life might be dwarfed by his service in death, that I think when you see his the way he is facing his own mortality, it's incredibly, incredibly impressive. And his heroism only rises in my estimation.
And now when you were talking a moment ago about the sheer numbers, you know, it occurred to me that institutions that operate on this scale rarely are known for quality treatment and personal service, but not one of the patients that you talk to in this film talks about being treated like a number at the Mayo Clinic. And my question, I guess, is how does such a vast operation manage to offer that kind of personalized attention and sincere human connection between a doctor and a patient?
This is why you want to go and visit the Mayo Clinic and see what it's about. I mean, I'm just like you. I'm just a regular citizen. And I look at this and I go, why? You know, we know how to make French fries exactly the same from Anchorage to St. Augustine, right? Yeah. But you know, you presume that level of quality care at the ultimate, you know, tipping point of our lives, our health or lack thereof, would be impossible to do at that scale. And yet they do it because I think that they have this parallel sense of their mission, that if you're in the medical profession to make a lot of bucks, you're not going to be at Mayo Clinic. If you're there because you love the collaborative spirit, then you're going to be self-selecting for a kind of culture that is going to promote all of this. And if you continue to do that without shareholders breathing down your back because you're a nonprofit and you're plowing everything into research and education and better patient care, then you have this extraordinary recipe for excellence. And, you know, we call our film the Mayo Clinic Faith, Hope, and Science.
Yeah, and I'm very interested in this partnership between faith and science that really goes from the founding of this institution all the way to the modern day, because here you had an agnostic medical doctor who preached Darwinism partnering up with a devout Franciscan nun. You know, so often faith and science are at odds. How do they come into play with the philosophy of treatment here?
We had one patient, Dr. Kendall Lee, who does this extraordinary deep brain stimulation. And he was told by one of the sisters to treat each patient as if they were Jesus Christ. And, you know, when you go through it, it may not be that, but it's pretty darn close often. And the success rate as a result of creating a spirit of that kind of collaborative nature, not just between the people who work there, but with you, that you're part of it, that they're listening to you, and you're in an environment of extraordinarily amazing architecture. From the very beginning, I mean, they built the tallest building in the state back in the 1920s, the Plummer Building, and it had a 23-bell carillon. You do not need bells to make people better, or do you? And they've got hundreds of millions of dollars worth of art in their Gonda and Mayo buildings and in their other campuses across the country. And so you suddenly begin to realize they're trying to create an environment from the moment you walk in the door that is conductive to healing. We want to know about you and what your experience is. We'll spend as much time as you need. I'm going to bring in all of my associates who may know more than me. And I admit that I'm not God, as most doctors, I imagine, have a hard time doing, and that we're going together with this extraordinary staff, the person who brings you the food, the person who changes your bedpan, the person who changes your sheets, the nurse that's watching over you. We're going to all be together with you and your family in this struggle. That is just unheard of. I mean, there are great hospitals all over this country, and nothing I'm saying is taking away from the superb care that you can get in any metropolitan area. And I even think, from my work on that series about the history of cancer, even in remote rural areas. But I don't think anybody does it quite the same as the Mayo Clinic. And that's why I thought it was worthy of us, you know, just as we were interested in the celibate sect, the Shakers, or the Civil War, or baseball, or jazz, now upcoming country music, stuff that's about us tells us a lot about who we were then, but a lot about who we are now, or at least who we'd like to be in the future. And that's, you know, I like what Mayo says. And again, I want to stress that this is not a Valentine. We're not blowing wet kisses at the Mayo Clinic. We're tough on a lot of different things, and access in healthcare is always problematic, and it's true at the Mayo, and doctors misdiagnose, and diseases are pernicious, and people die. And, you know, but all in all, you can look at it and say, whoa, that's Babe Ruth. That's Michael Jordan. That's LeBron James happening, right? That's Tom Brady of this particular area.
This sort of holistic approach to treatment seems like something so natural and intuitive, but it isn't something that we see in medicine very often. Usually it's either faith or science, or it's hope or faith, or you can either treat a lot of people or you can treat a few people well. But somehow the Mayo Clinic seems to encompass all of it.
So I think that in some ways, we in our storytelling as human beings, particularly in a media culture that's oversaturated, we have to sort of accentuate these dichotomies, these opposites. Everything's a one or a zero, right? Mm-hmm. It just seems to be black and white. But if you back up, as I've had the privilege to do throughout the course of my professional life, and look at American history, you find that the stuff that you'd rather not deal with about religious freedom is as equally important in many ways and leads to things that are central to our lives, regardless of our religious beliefs or affiliations, as is our supposedly sacrosanct political narrative. That is to say, American history is not just a sequence of presidential administrations punctuated by wars. That's a pretty good way to get an initial understanding of it and to get a working familiarity with it. But you have to go farther afield and understand the power that was unleashed in the human spirit, in the spiritual dimensions of the creation of this country, that I could worship for the first time, worship God the way I saw fit, not the way the state or the royalty told me to. And you end up with an American catechism articulated, I suppose, by Emerson and inherited by Thoreau and John Muir that creates national parks and also informs somebody like a W.W. Mayo. He's a Quaker. He studied with a chemist in England named John Dalton. That's where his chops are coming from. But he's also coming to America, where it's the philosopher Jacob Needleman told me for my Shaker film 35 years ago, America's the land of zero, he said. We start from nothing. We start from our own longing, our own search. And so you have this idea of being able to make again something new. And that is, for all the stresses and strains, for all the undertow and complications and contradictions of this life and any other time in American history, still the operative thing. We have the possibility to press a reset button and figure out how we can remake ourselves. And what's so great about the Mayo is that they've been doing that continually. They are not resting on their laurels. How can they? This is a complicated healthcare environment with lots of moving parts and lots of changing moving parts. And they've got to be as nimble as the most successful for-profit healthcare. And they are. But they also manage to deliver the best care on earth.
Well, Ken, the personal testimonials from patients are really one of the best aspects of this documentary. Before we go, is there one in particular that stood out to you?
You know, I've been touring the country with Chris Ewers and Eric Ewers, my co-directors on this, and our producer, Julie Kaufman, and our writer, David Blistein. And everywhere we go, something bubbles up to the surface and says, oh, yeah, what about this person? You know, there's a wonderful moment in the film when a concert violinist named Roger Frisch discovers that he has a tremor that is going to end his profession. And he goes to 15 specialists and nobody can figure out what to do. They drug him and that makes him a less good musician, too, in addition to this tremor that is getting worse and worse and worse. And they are experimenting and applying this deep brain stimulation in which you drill holes in people's heads and you place in some electrodes. And the rest of the story is as flabbergasting as anything I have ever been involved with as a filmmaker in all of my 40-plus years of making films. And I have seen this now, this scene, 150 times, and I still just shake my head. It feels like science fiction. It feels like magic. It feels like a miracle, and yet it is pure science, and it is fantastic.
That moment absolutely blew me away, and I'll leave it to the folks to see how that ends. It is just such a special film. It's called The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science, and it airs September 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern on PBS. Ken Burns, thanks so much for talking with me.
Ben, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to Ken Burns for coming on the podcast. His film, The Mayo Clinic, Faith, Hope, Science, airs Tuesday, September 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern on PBS, with a repeat airing on Wednesday, September 26th. For more information, visit pbs.org. You deserve a better email marketing platform. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first. It's powerful email marketing with a personal touch. Their award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more. So you'll have everything you need to do your best email marketing yet. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.